I'm amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Happy Easter and welcome to the Playing Footsie show, brought to you in association with Trading 212. My name's Steve W, and this week, Sam Bankman-Fried was sentenced to 25 years for defrauding FTX investors, Ocado shares jumped on news of 10% revenue growth, and Reddit shares fell towards the end of the week as insiders started selling, which makes sense. I guess they've got to make some money somehow. But we don't have time to talk about any of those things. There are much more interesting and important things going on, and we're going to discuss them. I'm joined by Steve D. How are you, Steve? Happy Easter, and how has your week been?
Happy Easter, Steve. It's been an alright week, to be honest. I was only working up until Wednesday. I've had Thursday off and I've got Friday and all the way through the weekend and Monday off as well. So I've been to the butcher's today to get a nice lamb leg for Easter Sunday. We've got all the family coming round. I went there with the idea of getting around about 2 kilos of lamb leg, and I seem to have like invented some kind of mythical beast because they only come in sort of 1.5 kilos or 3.5 kilos. So I took the bigger one. So we'll be eating that for about 6 weeks, and I suppose that's a nice first world problem to have there. In terms of stock, Steve, pretty good week, to be honest. It's been pretty good for my beginning of year prediction, where I said I thought Disney might beat the S&P. Disney's had a 5% return this week, but it's not been my best performer. Enphase has done a little bit better than that. Zenda Group is very, very close to 5. And then just under that, I've got Adyen at 4, Carver at 3.29, Progeny at 3, Southern Copper again at 2.87. So pretty decent. Overall, that leaves my portfolio up about 0.88%, which compared to the VWRP, which is done essentially nout. Is a quite handy beat. So yeah, really happy with it, Steve. I think it's going pretty well. Made a couple of changes, but I'll tell you what I've sold later on, or what I've sold part of later on. But I have bought some shares in Dr. Horton, or DR Horton, that we discussed a couple of weeks ago. I will try and set that one out for people in a couple of weeks' time when I have chance to sort of like gather my thoughts into something a little bit more coherent. And I'm using old notes and new notes as well, so I need to sort of figure out where what exactly is really old and needs updating and what was all right before. So yeah, not bad, Steve. How about you? How's your week been, and how's your week in stocks been?
Yeah, that is pretty good as a return for you. My week's been all right. It's been the run-up to kind of time off, which inevitably means taking care of sort of childcare needs and figuring out what we're doing over the Easter kind of long weekend. We haven't really got much of a plan for it, which is sort of unusual for us. Normally, we're quite well organized for this sort of thing. But in the markets, I've done okay, I think. I've either underperformed or outperformed, depending on exactly what you compare it to. So I'm below the FTSE 100 and slightly and comfortably ahead of either the S&P or the VWRP for this week. So my best performing stock, we said we'd talk about portfolios next week at the start of the new financial year, because at the time we record this, strictly Q1 hasn't quite ended. And there is, I guess, the potential for any of the stocks that we talk about, not any of the stocks, because two of them from the UK and the market's closed for that. But some of the things that we might mention, we could, I suppose, conceivably go off and hammer the buy button before the end of the quarter. So we'll leave open that possibility and talk about them next time. But one of the stocks I bought recently is my best performer. It's up 9.5% this week. I won't say what it is yet, because I'll go all Warren Buffett and see if anyone wants to speculate about it in the comments. But with permission requested to delay revealing what it is until next week. It'll be back through the floor again by next week now. But and the rest of my portfolio hasn't done that well, fairly obviously, which is why I'm up less than 1% overall. But a reasonable week, I guess, generally sort of across the board. And what feels like a reasonable first quarter, I guess I ought to go back and review that, and I will do by the end of it. But it feels like Feels like both in the stock market in general and in my own portfolio, and I'm guessing in yours as well, Steve, the first 3 months of this year have been all right, right?
Yeah, really strong. I don't actually know that for certain, but I feel like it's been a pretty good sort of 3 month period. Well, I'm just looking now, I've just changed the chart from 5 days to 6 months. Yeah, it's been really strong. Just glancing across it now, Steve, it says about 16%. I'd have to check that. I'm not sure that's entirely correct, but that's a hell of a quarter if that's somewhere near correct. Have I added money in that? There's perhaps some additions in that as well, though, so I'll have to work that out. I'm not entirely sure that's correct, but portfolio for me is at all-time highs. I would suspect that quite a lot of people are approaching all-time highs, apart from the people who just buy monthly dividend stocks. They won't be, not unless they've added a lot more money to it. But yeah, I think it's going pretty well for me, Steve. I think I'm relatively happy, looking forward to getting this fake 13F put together. And we'll see exactly how we've done this time next week.
Mm. I mean, my portfolio is sort of at all-time highs at the moment. I always think people should not take it with a grain of salt, but they should be mindful when I tell them my portfolio is at all-time highs of, you would expect it to generally be going higher, partly because I'm putting more money into the thing every so often. That's not true this week, actually. I haven't put anything in this week, but if I'm adding, I'm planning on adding more than I'm planning on taking out over the next however long, so there's a natural upward push for the value of the portfolio, even if the stocks do nothing at all. And I reckon the kind of monthly dividend guys probably are close to all-time highs, because there are all-time high amounts that they've put in, basically. But my return thing looks decent as well at the moment. And I get that you can make your return number go up by selling your weakest performing things, right? So if you sell everything apart from the thing that's up 300%, your portfolio suddenly shows up 300%. But it's not just a matter of that either in my case. I'm reasonably pleased with how this quarter's gone. I think it's been a strong one for the market as well. And it's a good sign, I think, that both you and I seem to have had a reasonable quarter while neither of us owns Nvidia, which just keeps on going and going and going.
Yeah, it certainly does. And it's still going back to kicking myself, Steve, on that like sort of 125, 135 kind of argument I was having with myself, just trying to find that extra $10 and being a little bit greedy. Don't think I would have cared about that $10, Steve, if I'd just bought it and watched it run up. But hey, you can't win them all. It's a strange one, really, because we've missed the best performer, probably. I think it is the best performer. It must be the best performer. And we're still, you're beating the, we are both beating the index on a, in a dilution adjusted, obviously, because our portfolios are still relatively young. The amount that we put into them every year dilutes the returns, theoretically anyway. We're both beating the market on a, last time we worked it out in the end of the year, we were both beating on a diluted basis. So, despite missing the best performer, so there is another sort of arrow in the back of, it's impossible to beat the market. Again, obviously, young portfolios, it's still early. It may not happen over a 10-year period, but can't be too dissatisfied with how it's gone so far.
No, and it's fair to say that even if Nvidia is not the best performing S&P 500 stock since the start of the year, I definitely don't own the one that is, because I don't own anything that's done better than Nvidia. So if there is something out there, it's not anything that I own, and it's not anything that I'm aware of. I've also, I think, I'm pretty sure, missed the best FTSE 100 performer as well. I think it's still Rolls-Royce. Again, since the start of the year, that thing has kept on going. I thought it might, but I didn't think it might enough to try and buy it, say. So I think I've missed the best performer from the S&P 500, probably by extension the World Index, because that's so heavily US weighted that I think probably that's going to be Nvidia as well. And also the best performer from the FTSE 100. Steve, you're making a face like, no, there's nothing outdoing Nvidia at the moment.
Well, no, I just thought I'd have a look at the S&P 500 component year-to-date returns, and Nvidia isn't first. Nvidia is second. Do you want to have a guess at first? It's a bit of a meme stock.
Oh.
It's not, it's Supermicro Computer. I believe it has some, yeah, something to do with chips and summer in it. It's 260% this year to date so far. So NVIDIA's up 82.24. 3 and 4 will probably surprise you, Steve. 3 is Constellation Energy, up 58.17. Fourth is General Electric, GE, up 41.13. And then fifth, obviously, is Deckers, up 40.31. So, you know, friend of the show, Deckers. So, yeah, interesting performance that, Steve. I was, I was with you. I would have thought Nvidia was running wild at the top, but Supermicro, just 4 times the Nvidia return year to date.
So, Supermicro, I have heard of, at least. And yeah, you're right. It's a chips AI-ish type thing. Not got any real interest in it from a potential buying perspective, but I had at least heard of that. Constellation Energy, I have no idea what that is. You could tell me that was hydrogen, you could tell me that was wind farms, you could tell me that was basically anything, and I wouldn't know any better in this situation. And GE's done sort of surprisingly well for people who were brave enough to have a go with it a couple of years ago. They've spun out various things, they've reorganized quite well. They're actually quite well led from what I think of it as well, with one of the best industrial CEOs around. But yeah, I wasn't going to get to Supermicro, although I probably should have. I didn't realise quite how much it had boomed. I actually also don't think I knew it was in the S&P 500 either. And it's not a big surprise to see, in general, Johnny-come-latelys like Deckers performing pretty well, because the reason they're in the S&P 500 is, in a lot of cases, because they've been doing well and their market cap's been going higher. In some cases, like Tesla, it's because they've just about turned a profit recently. That was what eventually kind of got them in. If, they had a plenty big enough market cap. But a lot of the time, it's because they've just been growing to the right size and therefore they're on the up anyway. And so that's not a huge surprise, I don't think.
So just having a look now, Constellation Energy engages in the generation, supply, marketing of clean energy, renewable energy, products and solutions. The firm also offers wholesale energy retail products and services. So it's 58.71 billion market cap. So it's not a small fry to be going up as... I suppose GE isn't small fry either. Well, NVIDIA isn't small fry to be going up as big as... Yeah, I think Supermicro is not a particularly big company off the top. I think that might be more... maybe I'm going to say early double digits. I'm thinking 10 billion kind of area, but I could look quite silly saying that with it going up whatever it was, 250% in a year. But I didn't really know Constellation Energy as well, but yeah, it seems like a big old outfit trading at 37.5x earnings. So there's obviously something going on there that we don't quite understand. Its chart, Steve, is pretty incredible when you put it on the max. It's just been a long slope upwards, but then it's only got a few years of data in here, so perhaps it's a fairly recent IPO that I just didn't know existed.
Yeah, it might be sort of fairly recent IPO that's now up 3x in the last, or nearly 3x in the last 3 months or so. That's impressive stuff. Maybe we should look at Supermicro Computer at some point. I feel less incentivized to look at these things when I find out they're about 2.5x the price they were 3 months ago, but it's not impossible. That would be... you probably shouldn't just write things off just because they're up. Doesn't make them expensive any more than things are cheap just because they're down. But anyway, we should crack on a little bit. Steve, what have you consumed this week? I have a feeling this is going to be connected to the previous thing we were talking about, but do tell.
Yes, so actually it was something you sent over to me, Steve. You said, check this out. It was quite interesting. Wall Street Journal had done a little bit of a dive into the stock, into Carver's business, essentially. And they'd had a chat with the CEO about the various different things that they try to do to figure out where they're going to put the next Carver. But it was also a look at their sort of acquisition of Zoe's Kitchen and how they use that to sort of rapidly grow. So basically changing those into Carver stores fueled part of their growth. But that's all finished now. So really tacked onto the end of it was, well, where does Carver go from here kind of thing. So if you was interested in the pitch for Carver we did a few weeks ago, this is a decent little place to move on to next. It's for a shortish video. I think it's only about 8 or 10 minutes off the top of my head. There's quite a little bit of information packed into there, and maybe some bits and pieces that we didn't necessarily cover, and some insights from the CEO as well. So I'll pop it in the consumption part of the description, and if you want to check it out, it's there for you. Steve, have you consumed anything this week?
I have. The reason that's connected, by the way, to the thing we were talking about before is that when you asked me what was up the most over the last 3 months, I wanted to say Carver, and I didn't say Carver because I'm pretty sure Carver is not in the S&P 500. Then having got that in my head, I then struggled to get it out again and think of any decent other guesses. But yeah, it's very interesting, the Carver video, I thought. Anyway, I like their basic idea of trying to build up a kind of picture of what their customer looks like and then work out where you find that customer somewhere else. They put it in much more fancy kind of data AI driven terms and stuff that I can take or leave. But that's the basic idea, right? Try and work out who buys this stuff and then work out where those people are. And that's you can be as detailed as you like about that kind of thing. Yeah, this week I've consumed something from Wall Street Millennial, which is the YouTuber who talks about things they don't like very much and consider most things to be either a fad or a meme or a bubble or something along those lines. And they specialize in talking about how awful everything is. And the thing they've been talking about this time out is Boeing. They've released about 7 videos, I think, on all the evils in the world. Since this one, but I was watching their video on Boeing and I enjoyed it very much. If you're looking for a kind of history of exactly what's brought Boeing to the point that it's at the moment, it was recorded, by the way, before their CEO resigned this week. Also, hasn't resigned as such, but has announced that he's stepping down later on in the year, I think is where they're up to at the moment. But if you're interested in exactly the scope of the kind of scandals, and if you're thinking, look, there's a dip on Boeing's shares, but clearly they're in an industry that's basically a duopoly, so could this be an attractive entry thing? Well, I need to get my head around exactly how big these problems are. I think this is a pretty good thing to use to get your head around how big these problems are. Not because I believe everything that they say or necessarily agree with everything that they say, but I do think they present the facts accurately, and then when they interpret them, you can agree or disagree and think of it how you like. So there's lots of interesting stuff in terms of their relationship with their suppliers, the kind of culture of the place, so on so forth, whistleblowing and the like. And it gives you a good feel for exactly what has been reported as fact, as well as their kind of view on it. You can take or leave the views bit, but I would encourage, if you're thinking seriously about Boeing, and I think I'm probably not, to be honest, but I see stocks going down sharply and I sort of wonder sometimes whether there's an overreaction there. Boeing, I think, goes in the too hard to tell whether this is an overreaction pile, because there's just a bit too much uncertainty around the whole thing in general. But I thought it was a really good video. I recommend some of their stuff and not others, but this goes in the category of things that I thought were pretty good from Wall Street Millennial. Steve, you're staying away from Boeing, I assume.
I did buy Boeing before this CEO took over, just after the first, after they started having the issue with the flight computers. And I made a pretty decent return out of that. I sold it like 16, 17, 18% higher when there was a quiet period after that. And I realised it had run up way faster than I anticipated, and I shipped it off. But I mean, Airbus must be absolutely, like, just cannot believe what's going on, because they're literally in a duopoly with Boeing here, and Airbus hasn't done anything to earn the extra business except not cut corners. And when you're in a duopoly, there is no reason to cut corners or be shoddy or anything like that. There's nobody coming along to eat your dinner. You just, and there's not enough capacity for, Airbus to take all of Boeing's business. And Boeing doesn't have the capacity to take all of Airbus's business. So they can quite happily exist, raise prices, make loads and loads of money by just, churning out decent quality planes and decent quality software and decent quality maintenance and decent quality training. And that's all they need to do. And that's all Airbus does. They've not done anything spectacular. And they must be the first company ever to win a sector by the other part of the duopoly just failing so miserably. In terms of looking at Boeing again, no, not for me. No, I think there's just too much stuff going on now. From whistleblowers being shot, or was he hung, or did he commit suicide or something? That seems quite unlikely. The day before he was due to have his day in court. But yeah, and then there's panels flying off and there's doors flying off now and software doesn't work. And to me, this just seems like a company with a huge culture problem. And I'm not entirely sure that gets addressed anytime soon. So it might be interesting to check out the video, but only for a curiosity thing for me. I wouldn't touch Boeing ever again, I don't think.
Yeah, you said the two words there that I think are my two key ones here. One is culture that we sort of mentioned already. There's some interesting stuff in the video about basically people fishing scrap discarded bits out of bins to finish planes and that kind of thing, which is pretty frightening, to be honest. But the other thing was capacity. It's kind of weird, even in this sort of duopoly. I mean, Airbus it basically has the place to itself at the moment. And it's in some ways sort of struggling to really make the most of that because they haven't got the capacity, as you say, to take over the whole thing by themselves. So actually, there's still market there for Boeing. Switching costs in this industry are actually quite high because you have to retrain pilots every time you get a different type of plane and so on. But this is how the low-cost airlines do really quite well. They buy one type of plane and then just stick people on that and it keeps your training costs down. But that said, I mean, Boeing doesn't seem like the place to be at the moment, and I think the culture point is really winning out here. New CEO will take some time, but it's not that long since the last new CEO, is it? Or at least it doesn't feel like that long. Anyway, since Dave Calhoun took over in that job. Anyway, consumption aside, shall we move on to some stocks, Steve?
Yeah, sure. What have you got, Steve?
Well, Steve has spent pretty much all of this week answering questions. If you look at the Trading 212 forum, you can go and ask him some, actually. But he's been answering various questions from various people, some of whom may or may not have been me. So I thought I'd have a bash at a question for this time out. Mr. Yaz asked us a while ago whether we would share our thoughts on Relix and Diploma on the show. And the answer is no. I haven't got any thoughts on Relix at the moment. I'll go and find some for another day. But Diploma I thought I would talk about this week because we have talked about it on the show before. But the company's had an interesting week. The stock was up 10% yesterday, which is Wednesday. After some news, and it's very much a case that it's Diploma doing Diploma things, and that is a very, very positive thing. So, yeah, been a fan for some time. This is an industrial distribution conglomerate. They send out, they work out of three segments, their controls, seals, and life sciences. Life sciences involves kind of machinery. Seals involves kind of, nuts and bolts, more on those in a little bit. Controls is things like specialized components. Over the last 5 years, the stock's up 160 or so percent, not including, so that's your return plus the dividend, and the underlying business has done pretty well as well. Revenue's up 147%, operating income's up 150%. And that, by the way, bearing in mind this is a company that is strictly in the industrials space, we can say things in a little bit about why they're not prone to the usual industrial ups and downs from cyclicality, but in the last 5 years, there's been a pandemic, there's been massive inflation, there's been high interest rates, and there's been more than one recession in the UK. And Diploma has done very, very well. If you think, whatever you think an unhelpful macroeconomic environment looks like for Diploma, it's seen one of those in the last 5 years, and it's done pretty well, kind of regardless, which I think is probably worth taking note of here. So this thing grows in two ways. One is quote-unquote organically, and the other is quote-unquote inorganically, which I suppose is the only ways that anything can grow, because it's either organic or it isn't. But that is to say, it tries to buy things and add them on, so acquisitions, and it tries to get more out of the businesses it currently has. Getting more out of the businesses it currently has involves getting them into new markets. So if you have a small company and you have a large distribution network, you can help your small company sell things into markets it couldn't reach before because it didn't have a distribution network, and now it does. You can also add more products to your existing distribution things. You can share technical expertise, and you can avoid duplication of things like HR and accounting and the like. So lots of ways you can generate organic growth, which is to say a growth you didn't get just by acquiring things. But that's not what's been going on this week. This week, Diploma has acquired, or has announced that it is going to acquire, a company called Peerless Fasteners, which is, I think I said to you off air before we started, Steve, like the most Diploma company you can think of to buy. That's probably not quite true, because you probably couldn't think of it before you read about it in this thing. But they make nuts and bolts for the aerospace sector based in the US. And what they get from that then is a bigger presence outside the US, specifically in the EU, through Diploma's distribution network. Diploma increases its kind of US footprint, so immediate win on either side here. Peerless has been, by itself, as an independent and separate company, growing its earnings at about 9% per year. That's pretty good, you might think, and it's been doing that for some time. That's organic growth in this case. Diploma is paying on a forward earnings basis, a price that implies a PE ratio of 7. And that roughly tells you everything you need to know about Diploma and this particular acquisition. That's what they do. They find companies, they buy them at low multiples, and they add and grow their bottom line, dividend, everything like that. It's impressive stuff. Diploma shares themselves don't look cheap at today's prices. After that jump, they're at a PE ratio of about 42, which is not cheap by anyone's standards, especially not UK standards. But in fairness, this doesn't behave much like a UK FTSE 100 stock. 42 is a big number to pay of earnings for anything. Diploma is clearly doing very, very well. You can assume that the most recent acquisition is now priced in pretty well. It seems unlikely that it won't go through, but it's being built into that share price at the moment. I sort of wonder I feel like looking at a price earnings ratio of 42 is both intelligent and not intelligent. Here's the reason it is. It's expensive. There's growth priced into this thing. There is no question of that. If you try and work out what your returns are likely to be, then you will find pretty quickly that they only make any sense if that earnings number gets bigger. And that's correct. However, you could arguably have said the same thing 5 years ago. This was trading at a PE ratio of 33. Based on the amount that their earnings have grown, it's now trading on about 12 times those earnings. So if you wait 5 years, all of a sudden what you have is a growth machine that looks extremely cheap. I was thinking about this earlier this week when I was writing. It's got a £5 billion market cap. It feels to me like, I don't want to say it feels to me like, clearly is the case that it's a long time till they run into the law of large numbers. When you look at acquisitions, the problem with acquisitive companies is that they eventually make a mistake, they eventually overpay. And the reason they make mistakes and overpay is because they're running out of decent targets that can make a meaningful difference to their market cap. I think the Peerless acquisition, or at least Peerless future acquisition, is probably the best sign you can get that that's not happening to Diploma just yet. A 5 billion market cap means they have loads of opportunities that are too small for, say, the likes of Berkshire Hathaway. Feels like a Berkshire purchased this thing, actually. To be interested in, Buffett's not buying anything at whatever it was, a few hundred million in this case, because it's just not worth it. It's worth it to Diploma, though. And yeah, 7x earnings for something growing at 9% is just the kind of deal you don't seem to be able to do on the stock market at the moment. Steve, impressed?
Not impressed that you missed the opportunity to call this a bolt-on acquisition, Steve. But yeah, this is a really good strategic fit. You can see this. Diploma have an established position in aerospace fasteners. They're adding airframe to this as well, which means that it gives them a little broader product offering. You know, if you don't want this, could you take that kind of thing? So that's a really interesting little addition. Like you say, Steve, it's a really attractive valuation. It's like 7x next year's EBIT, I think they're saying here. So that's quite... that's not expensive in any way, shape, or form. It looks really pretty good. Organic revenue CAGR of 9%. significant headroom for growth because they're going to enter this new market. And Diploma obviously are buying a pretty decent management team here as well. And Diploma are a hands-off kind of manager. They're a bit like Berkshire in that they give these companies a nice home, and then they let them do their business. So yeah, it looks all. I mean, there's nothing in this announcement that you sort of scratch your head and think, well, what? Why have you? You know, why is this a? What? You know, why have you done that? This is, like you say, Steve, the most Diploma thing they could have possibly bought. And, it looks like it's going to tie in with everything they offer. Well, really, really well, to be honest. So, yeah, nothing to dislike in here at all, Steve.
One of the things to kind of note about these sort of nuts and bolts companies, that this is lifted straight out of the business breakdowns episode on this, by the way. It helps their kind of acyclicality in that if you have a plane or something that needs a nut or a bolt, it's unlikely you're going to leave that plane grounded because you don't want to buy a nut or a bolt in order to have it flying again. If you think big pieces of machinery, it doesn't have to be planes in Diploma's case, but this particular example is, big pieces of machinery when they're not doing stuff are effectively a waste for the people that own them. These are industrial manufacturing things. And yeah, there are downturns in those end markets. There are times when manufacturing is strong and times when it isn't. But even when it isn't, you don't want it to be the case that you're not manufacturing because you need something like a nut or a set of bolts or anything like that. So, I mean, that really helps with these kind of things. It helps their kind of cash flow, helps their, acyclicality, I guess, even though the end markets they sell into are quite cyclical. And that's an interesting and important point to, I think, notice here. It's, it adds to the very Diploma-like feel of it.
Yeah, just looking at the funding as well here, Steve. So, looks like they've extended bank facilities, $555 million revolving credit facility maturing in 2028. It's got a couple of one-year extension options on the top of that as well. And US private placement issuance, so a bond issuance, raising €250 million with a mix of 7, 10, and 12-year maturities, all in blended fixed coupon of 4.28%. So it would have been nice to have a look at them, I think. A 12-year of 4.2%. Well, I suppose it would have been a bit more than that, I would assume, the longer-term bonds. But a blended fixed coupon on 7, 10, and 12 at 4.28. Yeah, it's pretty attractive, I wouldn't imagine. And it's a decent return for the investor as well, so you can see why it was taken up. So, it looks like it's going to be made as a cash payment, $228 million in cash, and then the remaining 3.5% will be paid based on Peerless Management's performance in financial year 27 as well. So there's a little bit held back there and a little bit of incentive for them to carry on performing. And Diploma's balance sheet not hurt at all by this. Year-end leverage is about 1.3x with no further acquisitions, which I find is probably unlikely. Diploma will likely make two or three more between now and the end of the year. So, yeah, it looks all good to me, Steve. I think Diploma's one of those stocks that people look at and just think, you know, the 6% top-line growth and maybe 8% bottom-line growth, and they, you know, even though the free cash flow conversion is really high, usually 90%, people sort of look at that and think it's just too expensive. And as you say, 40 is a high number. 35, 40 is a high PE number. But when somebody's churning out consistent bottom line growth, those numbers soon diminish, and I think that's the case with Diploma. But is this one that do you still own this one, Steve? Or is this one that you've got rid of?
I have got rid of it. I very artlessly got rid of it at a time when it was a lot cheaper than it is now. That's not always been the case with my stocks that I've sold, especially my UK stocks, actually. But no, this was a very, very badly timed sell on my case. I had a sort of value burst and thought, I'm done with waiting for Diploma to do stuff. I think this number is just too high that I'm currently selling out. I'm not quite sure exactly where it was, but it was a lot lower than it is now. And that was a very, very bad move. And that makes it that bit harder to try and get back into it at these prices. Even though, when you look at this, then, okay, they're financing it with 4% and something here, and they're buying it at an earnings yield of about 15 or something like that. And I think even in their first year, they're going to get more than 4% back in this to make their debt payments. So they're well away from the get-go, as far as I can tell. Plus, as we've been pointing out, even with a company like Diploma, you can justify playing slightly higher multiples if you think you're going to get better returns out of this company than it can generate by itself. Okay, you're growing at 9%, let's suppose, and you're paying getting an earnings yield to start off with of, let's say, 15, just to round it a little bit. Sure, but you can expect that number to go higher in the case of Diploma, so you can justify paying slightly better than that. Not that they have in this case. So, yeah, I'm impressed by this. I do not still own it. I'm going to say I wish I did. If I hadn't sold it when I did, I'd probably have sold it since, because I'm not very good like that. I am staring at Southern Copper and refusing to go anywhere near that sell button, because at least it makes my portfolio look nicer with a big green number next to it. It would have looked a lot nicer with Diploma shares still there, though, Steve.
Fair enough. Would you like me to shuffle on to Forterra?
Yes, talk about a UK company that isn't so good.
Okay. So I'd forgotten that these earnings were coming out. Steve had to remind me that they were coming out later in the week, and then we both got the day wrong as well. So it was a surprise when they came out. So that's some behind the scenes professionalism for you. But yeah, I came across the report, and I obviously knew how the share had performed the next day. And I said to Steve, it must be a fairly middling report, because I think the share had pretty much bobbed around 0.25 or 0.35% down. So I thought this was going to be a pretty run-of-the-mill report, but I actually thought it was a very disappointing report, and I thought management did a pretty bad job of highlighting the odd few bright spots that were in the report. So so I mentioned last time that we covered this that brick dispatches were down, and I said that they were at levels not seen since the financial crisis, and that has continued. Brick dispatches are down about 30% in the market, and obviously Britain remains fractionally in a recession at the moment, with only 0.1% GDP growth on the year. And Forterra deserves credit for making great strides in creating the it's Europe's largest, most efficient brick factory at New Desford. And it deserves credit for mothballing the other sites quickly to reduce its outgoings and to counter the softening in the market. It's also looking at spending about $30 million on its Wilmcote factory, which is more sort of commercial and specification market, and they're expected to start that again in the second half of this year. Let's just take a quick look at the financials. So revenue for Forterra was down 24% on the year to $346.4 million. EBITDA fell 35% to just $58 million, and profit before tax ended up around $31.1 million, which is down 56% year on year. So looking specifically at the brick and block department, Forterra performed marginally better than the market, with its brick revenue down 26.2%. But here's some more of the bad stuff. Net debt rose from $5.9 million to $93.2 million. Inventory at Forterra has pretty much doubled. Forterra's drawn two-thirds of its credit revolver, meaning they're essentially three times leveraged come the end of this year. Their covenant, let me remind you, a covenant is when two parties agree that certain activities will or will not be carried out, is that they will not exceed three times leverage. So they're just changing the covenant or relaxing them, as they call it in their release. They're now going to just move it up to 4x because, you know, what's the point in having them if you just change them when the going gets tough? Annoyingly, Steve, they're still paying a dividend, and whether you like it or not, they're paying this with debt, and it won't be debt. That's at a decent, you know, rate. I think this is a really poor move. I would have sooner than just be honest and cancel it. And I went to go look at the broader market, and I was pretty dismayed to see that brick imports only fell by 4 percentage points last year So this is pretty much the UK brickmakers shouldering this this issue. And you can definitely see that in Forterra's results. So in terms of their cash position, it's halved to just 16 million, with 25% of this being wasted on the dividend. And with the exceptionally wet weather we've had to start this year, that's meant that 2024 has been a sputtering, sort of misfiring kind of start for them. So I am still optimistic for the market long term, because I work in the sector and I'm in serious trouble if I'm not optimistic about it, and it goes the way of me not being optimistic. But this is not a good earnings report, Steve. I was pretty disappointed. I think Forterra isn't performing at the moment. I'm going to give them a D minus on their report card, Steve, to take home to their parents at Easter. And I actually reduced this position right down to about 0.5% of the portfolio. So I've still got a stake in it, but it's a much, much smaller position than I had prior to reading this report. And all of that money has gone into Dr. Horton in America. Steve, what did you spot?
I agreed with you on, I think, most of this. Here's the thing where I think other people felt differently that I agreed with you on. That Desford factory, I was reasonably convinced that this was a good move. It's one of these things where if you look back in from where we are now to where we were then, it sounds like it was kind of catastrophically badly timed, right? You ended up upping your production capacity at a time when demand was about to fall off a cliff, and was arguably quite obviously about to fall off a cliff as well. Interest rates had to go one way. That had to make mortgage rates go up. That had to slow down the property market. And it was only another small step, I think, to think that what the builders are going to do is just slow down building activity and maintain margins at a kind of cost of revenues. I'm okay with the idea that, look, you try and make hay when the sun shines. They had a big period of being very strong for cash generation, good sales. And look, how are you going to build your 140 million factory? When are you going to be able to build that now? That doesn't seem likely to me. So I'm okay with that in ways that it looks. But I do get that, you know, if you look back, there is a lens through which you can see that as catastrophically bad timing and nothing other than that, but I'm broadly positive on it. I also tried to have a look around the market a little bit, and on the same day that I was busy forgetting about Forterra's earnings report, Michelmersh, which is a much smaller UK brick manufacturer, were busy releasing their report. And their report looks almost nothing like Forterra's, from what I can see of it. So you said it was UK brick companies mostly shouldering the kind of decline in demand here. It's not Michelmersh. Their like-for-like sales were up by about 1% year over year. And look, 1% isn't much, but up is up. And when you're looking at your, not necessarily your rival, they're about a fifth of the size of Forterra, so they're not kind of busy battling it out shoulder to shoulder or anything. But when you're looking at a 24% decline on Forterra, a 1% gain for Michelmersh looks pretty strong. The reason for that was that they decided against pushing, or well, one reason for that, not the reason for that, it's far too cynical. One reason for that was they decided against pushing up prices particularly, and in with inflation and energy costs going up, that did lead to operating margins pinching in a little bit here. Nonetheless, they've managed to achieve a bunch of things that Forterra hasn't. For one thing, they're still net cash positive. They have 11 million in cash on their balance sheet. That's about 10% of their market cap, by the way, with the size of that organisation. They're doing about 2 million in buybacks. Why not? They've got a dividend still going, because apparently that's the rules if you're a brick company. But in fairness, it makes sense for these guys. They've got cash lying around. It comes with a yield of about 4.39%, which brings us to Forterra's dividend. I, like you, am confused as to why they're still paying a dividend. They cut it quite significantly, so it's not like they're have dreams of being a dividend aristocrat or something like that, right? And pointing out, look at our consistent years of however many years of dividend growth. I mean, no one ought to take that seriously anyway from a company like this. Of course it goes up and of course it goes down. Of course there are years when it's massive and years when it's not. But I'm not sure what cutting it like they did really achieves here. I mean, I get that some companies get hung up on their dividend, And I'm not critical of this particularly, but if you think Taylor Wimpey or something, where you think we're not busy tying our dividend to cash flows, we're tying our dividend to assets, so we will keep paying it even when it's not covered by earnings, because that's just the way we operate. We're in a cyclical industry. We think when it turns down, that's fine. We'll patch it up with debt and we'll fix it when things get better. No reason for Forterra to be like that, and especially not if they're also going to cut the dividend quite dramatically. I would have rather they got rid of the whole damn thing. To the point about debt covenants, I'm not entirely sure I understand that it is a debt covenant. I mean, late Charlie Munger, he was talking about bank balance sheets, to be honest, but he had this kind of category of assets that he called good until reached for, which is to say they like show up on your official filings and stuff, but if you ever got into trouble and had to draw on them, you wouldn't be able to, which is to say, so, okay. I mean, they count for accounting purposes, but realistically, they're not actual assets and you shouldn't treat them like that. I sort of feel that way about a debt covenant, that you just relax when you get near it, to be honest. I mean, it's kind of a covenant until it actually comes to be a covenant, and then it turns out it's not really a covenant. So you're thinking, okay, sort of three turns, which is, by the way, I think much too high for something in this kind of area. We were talking the other week about Kraft Heinz, and that's about three times levered. But look, Kraft Heinz is significantly more predictable and significantly less cyclical than Forterra is. Maybe over the long term, there's a kind of growth tailwind behind Forterra that there isn't behind packaged foods, because more and more people got to find somewhere to live and we're running out of space and so on and so forth. But I'm not keen on the... I thought three times levered was quite high anyway for this type of business, and then relaxing it when you get there. I understand that the number of times levered you are depends on what your earnings look like, and they could be lower than average in any given year. But I'm not entirely sure I understand in what sense this is even a covenant. When you get near it, it gets kind of wider and stops being a covenant. But yeah, probably the most galling thing, I think, was to discover that this isn't just the brick industry getting hammered here. Michelmersh's kind of more diversified end user base is actually holding up quite well, and that thing's in pretty good shape. Not tempted to look there as well as DRH.
No, not particularly. Just back to the I know we're still going on about debt, but it says to me, when you're reducing the dividend by that amount, that says to me that the CFO and the CEO have got together and realised that the current dividend prior to the cut is too much. So what you want in that scenario is a strong CEO that says, well, look, we shouldn't be paying a dividend because all of this has happened. We've had to mothball factories and probably put a lot of people out of work, you know, because business is so bad. We shouldn't be paying a dividend. But what you get here is a CEO who seems afraid to use the levers that have been given to them. Do you know what I mean? And that worries me a little bit when you think about Forterra, because what you want is a strong CEO who says, look, the business is in, it's not in dire straits, but it's not doing very well. When businesses don't do very well, they shouldn't pay a dividend. When businesses are drawing down from credit revolvers and not making acquisitions and things like that with it, they shouldn't be paying out dividends, no matter how small. So it worries me at this point that there's some kind of like, oh, well, we must pay a dividend because, you know, the previous people paid a dividend, therefore we shall continue paying a dividend, rather than somebody standing up and saying, look, I'm the CEO, I'm in charge of this company, and we bloody aren't paying a dividend. You know, you can get stuffed if you think you're getting one. And that's kind of the response I was hoping for when I read for this, and yeah, I didn't get it. So to be honest with you, Steve, I was amazed that this stock was only down 0.2%. Now, this is the sort of report where you pull up and because you've got to remember as well, this is the half after the half that they told us that Forterra would be getting back to business, and at the moment it's still suffering. And they're telling us that it'll be maybe not even this year that we see some rapid improvements from Forterra. If you just look at their predictions on housing completions, they're expecting less houses to be completed this year than next year. They're expecting 134,000 last year, and they're predicting 129,000 this year. So, why you would pay you know, one of the reasons you could say I'm paying a dividend is that you think, well, basically the second half of the year is going to be great anyway, so it doesn't really matter. But they're not. They're predicting 2024 to be as bad as 2023, and they're still committed to, retaining cash to shareholders from their pile of debt. So, yeah, not impressed, Steve. The more I think about it, the more that we talk about it here, the more I want to cut the thing entirely, which is quite irritating. But I'd be interested to hear, because I know a lot of people, we're interested in Forterra last time we spoke about it. I know a lot of people owned it. I'd be interested to hear what they think of this report and what their plan is as well. What have you got any plans for it, Steve? Are you just going to sit on it, or is this something that you think is quite considerably on the chopping block for you?
Well, my instinct was that I want to sit on it, and I want to sit on it because I think the long-term thesis on this is probably still reasonably intact. The main things that I thought were going to help this company get profitable over time weren't, although I had noted a strong balance sheet, which I now don't think is a strong balance sheet. I think it's to do with essentially supply and demand in the UK's housing market. Leave aside for the moment concerns about the number of bricks needed from passive house initiatives. But yeah, it's like the opposite of business breakdowns, isn't it? Where every time I listen to an episode of their stuff, I want to go and buy the stock. When I start talking about this, I want to sell it. And here's, considering that I think the right way to think about this is as a, from a long-term, very long-term perspective, like more than the next few months and years even, the dividend stuff feels incredibly short-termist to me, because I think this thing has a market cap of $366 million, $93 million now in net debt. I think there's a real danger that all the dividends that people are getting, they might well be asked to give them back again, because that's quite a lot of debt for this company to be servicing, especially if we have anything like a further extended downturn that they're expecting. I wouldn't be massively surprised to see an equity raise in the next sort of year if things don't start looking up, which they're saying it won't necessarily start looking up. And that will just mean that Forterra's shareholders, including you and me if we are at that stage, are just going to end up giving them back again. Paying dividends at this stage, I'm quite wary of that, and I'm concerned that we may have to give it back along the way.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. See, I'm just looking here. I found a longer-term prediction from them as well, and if they're even saying full year 2025, there's going to be just less than the amount of housing starts that we had in 2023, which was a bad year for them. So they're predicting 2 years out here of pretty stinky returns on the bricks here. So I don't know here. I think you're probably right. I think the issue people have with taking a dividend now, and the issue I have with dividend investors, go, ooh, 2p, that's great, per share. Yeah, I'm so happy with that. Is that they don't realise that paying it from debt hampers the company's ability to pay better dividends in the future years. So one of the things they're going to do now is to pay your 2p now when they're not doing very well, to draw down $110 million from a credit revolver, means that in, say, 2025, if we get 250,000 housing starts and 250,000 houses built, or like we did in 2007, we got about 225,000 starts, 225,000 built, Forterra would have a stellar year if that was to happen. But you wouldn't see the returns from that, because they'd have to, you know, sort out all of the issues that they created previously by continuing to commit to a dividend, which, I mean, it's 2p, it's just not worth receiving. Not particularly chuffed with this one at the moment, but I'm prepared to sit on it, Steve, because I, like you, I think the long-term thesis is intact, and you know, potentially this is a place where we should really be picking up more shares. But I am not confident that Forterra's current management team are the people I really want to back to turn this one around.
I'm not buying it at the moment. It's big enough as a part of my portfolio. Should we move on to something a bit more positive, Steve?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so let's start with some kind of word association. stuff. In a moment, Steve, I'll ask you what you thought, what you associate with the year 2020. And just to give you a bit of thinking time, I'll say some things that happened around then. So it was still during COVID. Biden took over from Trump. We saw the killing of George Floyd and all the stuff that kind of followed that. This is around that time. The stock market was in a much different place. Oh, and Paul Briscoe was a thing back in 2020. Paul Briscoe was trying to be a thing back in 2020. I don't mind saying these things because I don't think he'll hear it. Anyway, what did you associate with 2020, Steve?
So that was the year that we were all locked down, wasn't it? So was it 2019 mm-hmm. was the year we found COVID towards the back end of the year. 2020 mm-hmm. was the sort of period where both you and I thought this was just going to blow over. And it went wild. And I seem to remember that just being a roaring year for stocks, if I can remember quite. I remember it being a bad middle. I think the stocks lost about 30-35% off the top of my head, 30-35%, and then, or maybe not that much, maybe 20-25%. And then I remember it going absolutely wild after then. You literally could put your money in anything, and it was like doubling in a month or two's time. It was crazy. And I remember Paul kept telling us, it was all going to end in misery, and it didn't, not for a long time. It went on for quite a while, all the way through the early parts of 2021. I remember at one point my portfolio went from a standing start to, because I'd moved from free trade to trading 212, and it went from a standing start to like 65% up in just less than a few months' time. So yeah, I remember it quite fondly, but it obviously it all unraveled fairly quickly. But go on, Steve, am I on the right kind of lines?
You are. Those heady days of interest rates being, in real terms, below zero, as we had a bit of inflation and absolutely nothing going on in the interest rates division. Stocks went wild, and the kind of madder the stocks were, the more we kind of liked them. And in some cases, Paul was right. It did end in tears. In some cases, he was wrong. Hiding in 3M was not the way to get rich, it turned out. But one of the stocks that people talked about a lot back then, I did some searching on Google Trends, was Mercado Libre. A nice Latin American Amazon, if you wanted to call it that, which you probably shouldn't have. More of that in a moment. It's a stock that we've kind of forgotten about, though, in the sort of intervening 4 years. I had a look at the search volume for Mercado Libre shares, and it's about a quarter now of what it was back in 2020 when we were in, I want to say peak growth stock. Basically, and there were some of them like Teladoc that didn't turn out terribly well, but I don't think Mercado Libre is in that territory. Back then it was trading at around $1,600 a share, and then it went down quite a lot, and now it's made its way back up to $1,500 or so dollars a share last I looked. So it's roughly back at its 2020 levels. If you bought the thing back then, there's no dividends, so you've effectively gone nowhere apart from maybe some foreign exchange movements, which are neither kind of here nor there for the purposes of this. But look, the underlying business appears to me like it's improved kind of really quite a lot. And I've gone from now thinking, gosh, this is overpriced, I think with some justification at 1600 back in 2020, thinking that was quite expensive, to now wondering whether it looks like a more interesting sort of proposition. See what you think. So just a reminder for anyone that's been staring down the barrel of dividend stocks for the last 3 years, because that was all there was to do, and or Rolls-Royce and or Tesla. Mercado Libre is based throughout Latin America, and it is effectively an e-commerce platform. So e-commerce involves a bunch of stuff. There's the platform you sell it on, there's your paying for it, there's your shipping it. And Mercado Libre thinks, well, let's do all of these things. It started out life as a kind of marketplace, so think eBay rather than Amazon, where people list stuff, and that's a perfectly nice business model. And then they thought, a bit like eBay actually, maybe we should help them with the payments thing, because paying for stuff is difficult. And so they built out a payment processing platform. And then they thought, well, actually, what's the hardest bit about selling stuff? Probably shipping it to people, because you've got to like package it and stuff, and that's a arse. So they built out a shipping business, a logistics firm basically, which all of these are called Mercado various things. Mercado Libre, Mercado Pago, Mercado Envios, and there's now Mercado Credito, which is a lending business to help people finance these operations. So everything you need to become an online salesperson. apart from the physical stuff. But hey, look, there's Etsy where people sell spreadsheets, so that's clearly not a thing that you actually need. Anyway, the obvious thing, one more bit of word association then, Steve. This could go one of two ways. We didn't rehearse this. I didn't particularly tip you that we were going this way. But I'll write down my kind of bingo card of three things. And you tell me what the first thing that comes to mind is when I say to you, Argentina.
The crazy guy who's in... is Milei, Javier Milei.
Interestingly, that was none of the three things I'd written down. See, I told you we don't practice these things, but it is adjacent to one of them. The first thing I'd written down was steak. The second thing I'd written down was Lionel Messi. And the third thing I'd written down was inflation. And it's kind of adjacent to the third one of those. So one thing to note then about buying Mercado Libre shares, let's get the kind of risky bit up front here, is that, yeah, you are looking at buying a... shares in a company that is based in the country with the highest inflation rate in the world, bar none. And if you've recently owned Airtel Africa shares and you think I've had enough of this foreign currency stuff for one basically lifetime, I would have some sympathy with that thought. But we'll come back to it in a moment. This is Argentina, where they're currently pleased that their month-to-month inflation rate is about 12.5%, not year over year, month over month. And they're kind of pleased about that because it used to be about 20 something percent, like the month before that. Inflation here is kind of a big thing. And as you point out, Javier Milei is attempting to get that under control as best anyone can. The trouble is the cost of getting that under control is massive austerity, which is not good for a company like Mercado Libre, which requires people to buy stuff, and austerity is sort of largely opposed to that in basic terms. Anyway, I was looking at the business then and now, aside for, and we can talk inflation a little bit more if you want in a bit. So there are some kind of KPIs, key performance indicators, important metrics you might look at for each of these parts of the business. I'll leave aside the credits one for the moment because I'm not a massive fan of it, but that's that wasn't a thing in 2020, I don't think either. Gross merchandise volume, so the amount of stuff getting sold on the marketplace platform, has gone from just under 21 billion in 2020 to 44.75 billion in 2023. So it's more than double. Total payment volume, i.e. the amount of cash going through the payment processing platform, has gone from just under 50 billion to just under 183 billion, so it's significantly higher. Add to that the fact that some of this is being spent off their platform as well as on it. The payment processor works quite well there as well. And that's quite a big lift. And the number of items they ship through their logistics thing has gone from 649 million in a year of 2020 to 1.4 billion. Add in the fact that they now do kind of 24-hour or 48-hour delivery. And things are looking kind of a lot more attractive from what I can see of it. And look, revenues are up really, really sharply between 2020 and 2024. Back then, a price tag of 1500 or so got you to about 20 times sales, which is quite high. It's the kind of thing that if you punch it into the wrong spreadsheets, they think is too high as an earnings number. But it's a price to sales number. Nowadays, the price to sales is closer to 5, which is significantly more in line with what you might think of from a maturing, but not yet mature, business. They have a heavy investment cycle going on, which means their earnings come out very low, but look at their free cash flow numbers make things look much more attractive. I sort of wonder whether this is worth another look here, Steve. There's also a sneak under the radar point here. So when I talk about kind of earnings per share and so on, that's actually the result of some fairly light stock-based comp, at least by what we consider to be big tech standards. When you look at what they offer out in stock-based comp, their share count hasn't gone up that much between 2020 and 2024. It has gone up, but not like you would expect from something in growth mode that is mostly attempting to pay its staff using shares because it can't pay its staff using cash. I mean, they've got a big share price, so stock-based comp is quite a bit if you get a few shares. But I wonder whether this is now closing in on more interesting buying territory. I mean, Their kind of Argentina GMV volumes were up about 200 and something percent year over year. They're kind of offsetting the effect of inflation there. This feels a bit sort of Visa, MasterCard-y to me, in the sense of actually some inflation is good because it means higher volumes just go through with the higher currency. The issue with both Visa, MasterCard and these guys is too much of that inflation and nobody can buy anything anymore, which means that the volumes fall off again. But I sort of wonder, Steve, any interest in any sign of this getting back into interesting territory? The stock is going up, not down at the moment, which makes it seem like the moment's passed. But what do you think about this? Any of that catch your attention?
So loads of it. And looking through this report again, it's one of those things where you think to yourself, it's kind of in that when I look through the Wise results at time and said to you, I'm not really sure why I don't own this stock. And I think it's the same thing with Mercado Libre. And I think that occasionally my big issue with Mercado Libre is that because I don't fully understand the economics of the areas it trades in, I worry about, you know, the unforeseen circumstances, which didn't stop me going into Airtel Africa and should have done. But I think Mercado Libre is a much better company for navigating those issues. And I'm just looking down these numbers now, Stephen. I mean, I know you don't want to talk about the credit section of it, but I'm going to do it anyway. Net interest margin after losses, Steve. What would you imagine that would be in a UK bank? Maybe...
A UK bank four is very good. It's usually between one and three.
Okay. 39.8 for Mercado Libre. And that just so the people who don't know, so NIMAL, net interest margin after losses, is basically revenues from your credit minus your provision for doubtful accounts and minus any sort of costs you have in funding. So it's quite a decent little statistic to use when you're looking at somebody who offers a credit product. But yeah, it's never been below 30 as far as I can see here. So 39, 30.6, 36.8, 37.4, 39.8. So it's actually getting stronger and stronger and stronger as it goes along after the dip in 23. So quite impressive, because the actual portfolio of credit has grown about 33% year on year. So this is careful, I would say, is probably what I would say when I look at this. I think they're trying very carefully just to grow out this credit product rather than offer it to absolutely everybody. The thing they are offering to absolutely everybody is the fintech platform, which is growing just exponentially. I mean, you're looking at the digital account growth. The TPV is up 258.8% year on year, and the TPN is up 76.2% year on year growth. So that is growing. That is growing really, really quickly. So yeah, look, it's a really, really impressive business that has kind of just grown into the areas that it didn't think the incumbent was good enough to satisfy, you know, the demand that Mercado Libre was presenting to them, and it's done a fine job of sort of navigating these areas. So yeah, really impressive, Steve. It's very difficult to look down these Q4 results and say that there's anything particularly bad in them at all. The interesting part is it actually fell quite considerably on the back of these results, and I think it was because earnings stayed relatively flat. But that looks like there's a one-time cost in the results here, Steve. So I don't think that was anything to be particularly worried about. Everything in here looks really, really good. I can't spot anything. So is this something you're thinking about buying, or is this something is perpetually thinking about buying like me?
It's not something I've been perpetually thinking about buying. It's something I sort of forgot about because I kind of wrote it off as once overvalued. And I think I was right, by the way, back in 2020. I think in 2020 it was expensive. It had a lot of work still to do. And I kind of get the impression that maybe it's done it, to be honest with you. I mean, if you look over the last, whatever I'm thinking here, 4 years or so, this is realistically an underperforming stock, but that's probably to be expected when you get up at those levels. But the fact it was undervalued at that price once doesn't mean it's undervalued at that price all the time. The other thing I have is a load of lousy psychological associations with thinking, Yeah, but stuff was garbage back in 2020 that I'd never heard of. I started buying a load of stuff that I, or didn't start buying stuff, but I kept seeing people talking about stuff that they couldn't possibly understand. And that was basically a picture of an EV in a lot of cases. This company ain't that. And I think it's probably proved that this company ain't that. On the Credito stuff, yeah, I like the word careful here. The reason I said I'm going to leave it to one side is because I've seen better companies get into a mess because they started doing lending and they messed up their lending. Lending's not as easy as it looks in some cases. But that said, so they've got a net interest margin after losses, even a net interest margin, suppose, for the moment, in the 30s or so. Sort of makes you wonder what rates they're lending these things out at, because I'm trying to work out who's borrowing off these people and generating them a margin of 30-odd percent with a return on these kind of things. And if they're interested in that, I mean, I got some money I can lend to people at 30-odd percent. I'll sell some Forterra shares and lend that out to somebody. Back in 2020, my sort of final thought here, you said the payment process has been going mad. When people tried to convince me, mostly on Paul's Discord, that Mercado Libre was in fact undervalued back then, they said, oh, people are not pricing in the Mercado Pago, the payment processor thing. And I thought that was a bunch of words being assembled in an order without much thought as to what they actually meant here. I mean, I got, largely speaking, the people who were telling me this, and I want to say I don't mean this to be unkind, but I kind of do, are people who I wouldn't trust to accurately value a £5 note. Telling me, yeah, they're not pricing in Pago with no sense of what they are pricing in or what value they're assigning to what here, didn't impress me very much. But this is another good case of needing to get past my own psychological biases here, maybe, in thinking that, look, the fact that there are dumb reasons for buying this does not mean that there are not also intelligent ones. We have this, let's call it the Dr. Martens effect for the moment, right? And the fact that idiots buy this for idiotic reasons isn't a reason, doesn't necessarily mean that there are not sensible reasons available that sensible people ought to be able to get their heads around and take note of. So I think the reasons I don't own this, Steve, are not very good ones associated with kind of psychological biases, and I wonder whether I might try and correct that after the time comes to report my 13F for this quarter.
So you've got me searching the Bank of Argentina base rate here. So you were right, Steve, monthly inflation down to 13.2%. That's monthly inflation. Okay. Year-on-year inflation, that leaves it at 276.2%. So in order to counter that, obviously, Standard Economics would tell you you've got to raise the policy interest rate. And they have done. It's currently at 80% APR.
So now I don't think you're on that interest margin thing is a typo anymore.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, it's not a typo. But then,
in fairness, I would start setting up an Argentinian lending business if I thought interest rates were at 80%.
Yeah, very interesting. Obviously, inflation not so good. But if you can get some, if you believe Milei brings inflation down to a sensible number. Which, to be fair, 13.2 is a fairly sensible number for Argentina monthly. But if you can bring it down to a sensible number of, you know, 2 or 3 or 5% or whatever he's aiming for, then booking some of the 80% right now is pretty incredible. I mean, he is a massive move away from sort of Peronism that Argentina has been famous for its politics. It's a completely different radical change for Argentina. So who knows? It's one of those old sayings that I got from Aswath Damodaran, and he said that inflation is irrelevant. What's the one of the big problems with inflation is changes in inflation. So if you told people that inflation was going to be 20% a year for the rest of their lives, then people would adapt and people would cope with that change in inflation, in the same way that if we tell them it's going to be 2%, they can change and adapt to suit 2%. The issue people have with inflation is when it's 2, 28, 64, 3,875. Do you know what I mean? That's the issue, because it becomes impossible for companies to successfully, companies and people to successfully adapt to the changes. So, yeah, I think we wait and see on this one. I'll pop another consumption in there for Patrick Boyle's take on Javier Milei. He's done a really good video on that. Might be a little bit of interesting follow-up information for people there. But, yeah, looks... looks all good to me, Steve. I worry about that inflation rate. That's probably the thing that would keep me up at night. But Meli as a company is doing fantastic.
It is doing impressive stuff, isn't it? How's your 40-minute episode working out, Steve?
Yes, yeah, we've blown that.
Yep. All right. Anyway, that was our show. Thank you very much for joining us. Happy Easter, everyone. And we will see you in the new financial year. Bye for now.